Hello, listeners. This is David Blakesley, welcoming you to episode 55 of the Criterion Reflections podcast, in which I and a couple of guests will be talking about Ingmar Bergman's 1971 film, The Touch, starring Elliot Gould, B.B. Anderson, and Max von Sydow. This is a film that was not, apparently, a real resounding success. It's been hard to access for many years, a little bit overshadowed by films like Cries and Whispers and Scenes from a Marriage, which Bergman filmed a couple years afterwards, and of course have towering reputations, or even some of his mid to late 60s work like Persona, The Hour of the Wolf, The Passion of Anna, Shame. The Touch kind of falls into this little nook and cranny kind of tucked away there. But we are going to have a conversation about it, and I think it's going to be an interesting one. I don't know exactly how people are going to react to it. I have a lot to say, but before we get into the details of Bergman's overlooked, neglected The Touch, let's introduce our guests, returning once again, Jordan Esso. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, David. Glad to be here.
Yeah, how you been doing lately?
Been doing really good. Yeah, and it's always nice to have a break from other responsibilities to think about Bergman.
Yeah, of course, Bergman. He's a touchstone. He's one of the main reasons that got me into this whole Criterion thing, going back to my first encounters with like The Seventh Seal and Wild Strawberries. And you know, this wasn't just movie watching. There's something deeper going on here, something really interesting. And of course, his casting is always very appealing. His actors and actresses are
most of the cast is appealing.
Well, even when they're a little bit repulsive, they're fascinating. Right? So, all right. Well, it's good to have you back. I was just kind of reflecting before we recorded. You were my very first guest, and it's always great to reconnect with you and get your insights and contributions here. So today you invited a guest along, and you've had a nice kind of tradition of doing that. Amido Taha has been a couple time appearance here. Do you want to introduce Norman Buckley?
Well, I think Norman would probably be best suited to describe himself, but I'll just say that, you know, he's a very active director right now in television, so just has an astonishing track record, and he's working on a new project right now for Netflix. And I knew that Norman was a Bergman devotee, like you and I are, David, and so I thought mm-hmm. it'd be really great to have him on to talk about this film that is not always celebrated, even by Bergman fans. So I guess we'll get into that. But Norm, would you like to say some words about your career or your perspective on film and why you wanted to join us today?
Well, I'll say I'm grateful that you asked me to be here, and I'm always interested in talking about film. I've always been a cinephile from the time I was a child, and I'm lucky enough to work in a business that allows me to do a lot of the things that have fascinated me so much. I'm a TV director. I've directed over 130 hours of television, and that's what I do, and I'm really grateful that I get to do it. It's kind of a dream job in a lot of ways. But thanks for having me here. I'm looking forward to this discussion.
Awesome.
Well, thank you for joining us, Norman. It's definitely a real treat. I do enjoy getting people who are doing the work, creative work in the industry, and bringing your expertise and experience into this conversation. I'm sure we'll have a few things to say about the craft of Bergman and Sven Nykvist filmmaking and all of that, and certainly welcome your observations of what you see happening on that more technical side. It's good to be able to pick this film apart a little bit. We are in 1971. Of course, all the films in this season are from that pivotal year. And we just got finished talking about Robert Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller, another pretty big title. And now here we are, Ingmar Bergman's up next in the queue. We're kind of in some pretty heavy territory here. So, Jordan, how about if I just let you kind of tell us a little bit about The Touch? How do you want to summarize that? I guess we could say it's a story of the indiscretions of a Swedish wife, to kind of paraphrase a Criterion title. Do you want to give us a little synopsis? What's this story about?
Sure. Yeah, it is mostly from the perspective of the character B.B. Anderson plays, named Karen. And she enters into an adulterous affair with an American who comes to visit the small Swedish town where she's living with her husband and her children. She's been married for about 15 years. And the man that she encounters is an archaeologist played by Elliot Gould named David. And Bergman describes this film as a love story, which is my first question mark, because it's not really how I read the story. And in fact, I think it's probably, in my opinion, best enjoyed if you don't think of it as a love story, because I think it's talking about and dissecting something different. But the arc of the narrative really just tracks their obsession with each other, David and Karen, and the cost of that obsession. And I think hints at other more interesting things, like about impulse versus desire, about existential crisis and how we try to cope with that. And I'm a fan. I would say I like this film.
Very good. And Norman, why don't you give us kind of your response? I mean, we don't need to get into the bottom line, but what was your take? I mean, have you seen The Touch before? What's your experience with this?
Yeah. When Jordan first asked me, I thought I had, and then when I saw it, I realized I've never seen it. And I think I had it confused with another film. And I do agree that I don't see it as a love story. I see it as a story of a certain kind of obsession. And I agree also that it's provoked by an existential crisis. And I didn't care for it. I found it somewhat clunky and touching on issues that then weren't further explored. And narratively, I just found it all over the place. But I was happy to watch it. And I watched it a second time and realized that even within that experience of not enjoying it, there are many things that I admire and like about it.
Fair. And I think we've got a pretty good representation of the mixed bag take that this film has generated. You can even go back to the original reviews from 1971. I might grab my book off the shelf at some point and quote a few of the writers who very much gave it a mixed review. Penelope Gilliatt of the New York Times, I believe, was very complimentary. She thought it was brilliant. And then there's another reviewer, his name escapes me at the moment, who just thought it was absurd and just ridiculous and really had nothing good to say about it at all. I know that's not where you're coming from, Norman, but yeah, there's definitely been a lot of ambivalence about The Touch. And even Bergman himself, in his two kind of, I would say, authoritative film biographies, The Magic Lantern and Images. The only mention that The Touch has is in a footnote when he kind of lumps it in with a few of his other so-called failures, like Face to Face and maybe another film or two that he's almost disowned.
And Serpent's Egg, I think, was one of the other ones.
Yeah, The Serpent's Egg. Yeah. And those are the three that are kind of derided, and of course Face to Face did not even make it into the Bergman box set. I don't think Criterion wanted to pass it up. I don't think they could get the rights, or they would have gladly included that. But even these so-called failures, I think, still give us a lot to ruminate upon. And I think Bergman probably has a pretty high standard himself, and the fact that the film was regarded, at least by a critical mass of reviewers, as a bit of a failure, he did not see any reason to embrace that. Let's talk just a little bit about the film as far as a deviation of sorts from the typical Bergman film, in that this was at least, probably two-thirds of the film was in spoken English. There's a little bit of Swedish where Max von Sydow and B.B. Anderson, Andreas and Karen are talking to each other and their family in their native Swedish. But a lot of the film is in English, with Elliot Gould, who was a super hot actor at the time. He had been cast in MASH, and of course that was a huge blockbuster hit, and was making other movies as well, and was a very bankable star. In fact, he gets top billing here. What do you guys think about just kind of the Americanization, if you will, of Ingmar Bergman?
Well, I think it's one of the problems with the film. I think the fact that a lot of it is in English, I don't feel that it's... It felt that people were struggling with the language. A lot of the dialogue just doesn't feel real to me. And I do also want to say that I feel I feel the permission to be critical of it since Bergman himself.
Oh, please do. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, since Bergman himself was critical of it, I thought, all right, then as long as, you know, because I do think he was a master filmmaker, so it's a little weird for me to even be suggesting that I think it's a bad film. But I do think his own struggle with it was one of the things that was evident to me, and it felt like a writer who didn't fully understand the vernacular of the English language, particularly American English. I had real problems with some of the dialogue. I just thought, really? Would they say that to one another? But that was just an initial thought.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting. Sometimes I think about Bergman's dialogue, even when it's all in Swedish, it's like, just the incredible bluntness and directness and ferocity of the character's dialogue. It's like, yeah, they might, in real life, they might think that, but boy, do they really unload it on each other like that? Maybe they do in Sweden. I don't know.
Well, in another language, that might very well be the case. I wish that I spoke Swedish so I could speak to that. But I think it's the way that we express ourselves in English is far different than some of the English that was in that movie, and some of it felt really clunky, particularly coming out of Elliot Gould's mouth. I don't know if you guys agree with that, but I thought that it was a performance that felt very stilted to me.
It feels like he doesn't understand what movie he's in. And I'm not sure where to ascribe that difficulty, that atonal quality to his performance, but I agree with you that there is some struggle even with B.B. Anderson in the English-speaking scenes. But when I watched it for the second time, I think I grew to appreciate her performance, and I really stopped finding it to have those clunky edges. But I don't know, there's nothing I can do to warm up to what Elliot Gould is doing there. And, you know, if directing is tone management, then maybe it's Bergman's fault. But he doesn't know how to pull off some of these lines that, even if they're written in a way that is awkward, like, it is the actor's responsibility to find a way to humanize them. And so when, you know, we hear him for the first time pleading to Karen, like, I need you to come now. Why can't you come now to me? It's like, what's the choice that's being made there?
Yeah.
I agree with that.
And I wonder, I mean, I guess in some ways I can sort of see it as a plausible indication of the character's kind of emotional constipation or something. I mean, he is a very conflicted soul, you know? And going back to the point about this being almost marketed as a love story, you know, the original posters, the tagline was, you know, the touch is the ultimate expression of love, or the purest expression of love. And you know, at casting a leading pair in the posters, it's Elliot Gould and B.B. Anderson. I mean, especially in the context of 1971, that's a pretty sexy couple, you know? And so if you are looking to get swept up in this, even if you go in knowing this is an illicit romance, this is a married woman's fling with a younger, hunky American guy, the story itself undercuts that appeal. He is not, you know, kind of some dashing, you know, virile young stud who's going to give this woman the thrill of her life. He's tormented. He's abusive. He's kind of nasty and horrible. And so to me, if I just accept the characters on those terms, that makes even some of that awkward dialogue a little bit more plausible, because he's a guy with some pretty deep problems, and she finds herself almost perversely attracted to that. I mean, the early scenes where he's wooing her and expressing how much he's in love with her at a quick moment at this dinner party, you know, she finds that perhaps flattering, and she's not used to being viewed that way, and there's this sexy otherness about him. But man, when he starts the kind of slapping and yelling and berating, I'm like, run, BB, run. get out of there.
Am I correct in this? I think that they considered Paul Newman for the part and Robert Redford for the part. I just was trying to imagine what a different movie it would have been. For instance, if Paul Newman had been playing that character, I find myself just thinking that it would have probably been a more interesting film relative to that he's a completely different kind of actor. Mm-hmm. Elliot Gould feels almost more comedic to me, and so there were mm-hmm. certain scenes that felt almost ridiculous,
yep.
as opposed to a sense of understanding her obsession with this relationship, why he was so compelling to her. It didn't make sense to me, and I don't know. I like Elliot Gould. I think Elliot Gould has been really fine in many performances, but I felt that this performance really drove the movie off the rails for me. I liked her. I thought she was good, but I felt in some scenes she had nobody hitting the ball back over the net to her.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I just felt there were moments where it just crashed and burned, and particularly in some of those apartment scenes when they were locked in that apartment, I just felt I want to get out.
Yeah, at no point now. You don't root for them ever. I at least I didn't. No, I never thought I want this passionate affair to light. I want it to continue. I am never enticed by them, and I don't think it's just that they don't have a great amount of charisma together as a pair. It's just that it's the writing. I would like to talk a little bit about, you know, I mentioned existential crisis, and Normie said, like, you feel that also is an important point. I think the way that story is constructed, even if in those scenes it fails to fulfill its premise in a wholly satisfactory way, I do think it's kind of smart the way that the Gould character, or David, I should say, is written to be this person who's very interested in his own self-destruction. Like that's it's very childish. It's very much like a teenager mindset that he's very interested in his own darkness. And it's what draws him to Karen at the very beginning, when we should say the very first scene, which is Karen's existential crisis, is that she goes to the hospital and she's a few minutes late and her mother dies before she gets there. And we sort of linger with her there in the room where she observes, you know, the various, you know, medical supplies, her mother's personal effects, the world outside going on, you know, without any knowledge of this personal tragedy. And
which is one of the best sequences, by the
yeah,
way.
I agree.
It's really brilliant.
Was
yeah.
stunning.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Totally agree. And then she breaks down, I guess, in a closet. And David, who is also, we don't know yet, but been a patient at the hospital, he sees her in this, you know, in this collapsed emotional state. And he reveals later that's the moment he fell in love with her. So he's attracted to brokenness. You know, he loves his own brokenness. He likes it in her. I'm never fully quite able to break down why she's attracted to him. I don't quite understand why the brokenness in him is so alluring to her, other than, you know, when people lose their parents, it's very common that, you know, they become very aware that they're next in line. And so this idea that death is now, you know, on their horizon makes them feel like you have to then find something in your life to bring it greater or more clear meaning. And so she tries to maybe fill that hole with David, even though clearly it's not doing anything for her. It is a narcotic distraction. And
I think it's kind of the bored housewife syndrome, if you want to. I mean, you know, there's those early domestic scenes of the little pop music playing on the radio as she's getting the children up and off to school. And, you know, there's even some good times. There's, you know, scenes of the family laughing together and, you know, kind of living that upper middle class dream. I mean, their home is very stylish. Her husband is successful. They have a social life and all of that. But when the kids are off to school and the husband's off to work, she's just sitting there at home in her beautifully decked out pad, smoking and
right.
nothing to do. So I think it taps into a, and especially, you know, you think about the, again, this period, late 60s, early 70s, kind of a high point in the feminist movement, and women kind of, you know, questioning domesticity and the limitations of even a successful suburban existence. What else is there? Again, it's not necessarily convincing or persuasive in the charisma point of view, but to me, David's kind of predatory instinct of looking for vulnerable women. I mean, you have a sense that this isn't the first time he's kind of targeted somebody and gotten into their business. You know, the way that he boldly proclaims how much he loves her. I mean, that's really socially inappropriate, you know? But after he sort of makes that declaration, she's kind of, you know, startled for a moment, but she maintains her composure, and he's kind of looking at her from the corner of his eye like, okay, that was my kind of opening maneuver here. And it just feels very, very manipulative. And again, going back to some of my work in mental health and family counseling and things of that sort, it's like, I know that type of character, you know, people who are just kind of shit stirrers, and they have a little bit of a kick out of just kind of creating turbulence in relationships and seeing what happens. There's not a grand plan, but it just sort of seems to be an inclination, and they end up kind of falling into the pit together, and, you know, chaos ensues.
Well, I think there's another way to look at it too, which is that I mean, just the idea of why is she attracted to him. Her relationship with her husband, with Andreas, seems very it just seems very polite. Mm-hmm. There doesn't seem to be a real sense of grand passion. He seems to be a real good husband, but on no level challenging to her. And to have somebody really see you at your worst, to have somebody see you ugly crying in a closet, and then for somebody to tell you that they love you and that they loved you in that moment, there's something about feeling seen that perhaps in the relationship to that point, that character had never felt seen. That's an interesting idea to me. That's an interesting idea to explore, that somebody, even though they're difficult, even though they're moody, even though they're, quite frankly, he's mean to her, and yet there's something about the authenticity of that relationship that goes beyond the politeness of the relationship with her husband. I mean, her husband never even seems to be that angry. He seems frustrated more than angry about the discovery of this affair. I think that all of us really desire to be seen. And that is an interesting idea, particularly upon watching the film a second time. I thought, There's something so compelling about that idea, but I don't think he was the right actor to kind of make me feel that he really saw her. Mm. You know, I think that another actor could have brought more of that to the table for her to play against. Mm. But theoretically, I like the idea. Somebody sees you for the first time sobbing, and they fall in love with you because they see your ability to feel really deeply. I don't know. That was just something that I was thinking a lot about.
I think it's really well observed.
After I watched it a second time.
Yeah, I agree.
I had definitely thought about what was missing from her life was passion. You know, even though I think smartly Bergman doesn't portray her domestic life as terrible or even harmful to her, it's dreary, but I think this way you put it, that it's lacking authenticity, is a really beautiful way to look at it, and that does make the appeal of someone like David make sense to me, that even though mm-hmm. it might be painful, even though it might create new anxieties, like the anxiety itself in its authenticity is refreshing.
That vitality, the burst of emotion, the unpredictability, the drama, the suspense of how is this going to go? I mean, that is all a stark contrast to the very placid, predictable stability. I mean, you know, life is so comfortable, so good that, you know, it's just kind of on cruise control. And, you know, and also let's think about her kind of disclosure when she and David first go to bed, and she can't just, you know, open up and let him in. She's got to kind of go through her catalog of self-doubts. You know, my bottom is too big, my breasts were nicer before I had children. And it's this very neurotic unpacking of all of her insecurities that she's kind of laying at his feet. And in a sense, again, it's a very sort of a toxic combination, because she's kind of just given him all the keys that he can play with to, you know, kind of dangle her on a string, jerk her along, and all of that. And yet that's the kind of disclosure that she has to make in order for her to kind of get over this hurdle of inhibition that makes the affair even possible. So, you know, I guess my bottom line on the relationship is that they're just not really good for each other, and yet they don't have any better alternatives. You know, she could just go back and stay, you know, in the status quo. He could, you know, drift from one, you know, shallow type of relationship, or just focus on his work or whatever. But it just feels like there's this kind of, you know, well, not necessarily fatal attraction, because they do kind of reach that point, at least towards the end, where they break it off. But it's still pretty conflicted. They're still pretty twisted around each other, and creating a little bit of residual damage in the people closest to them along the way.
And if the enemy of authenticity is lying, you know, it makes that not only the last line of the film make a lot of sense as a choice, but also the moments when their relationship becomes the most chaotic, you know, as violent and off-putting as the behavior from David is. Like, he's triggered by, I guess, what he perceives to be deceptions, you know. You were smoking and you weren't going to smoke is a kind of...
We had an agreement, right?
Yeah, it's a kind of lie, you know, to break an agreement. Mm-hmm. So I think that tracks. I'm now interested in maybe seeing it again, looking for those opposing forces in their relationship, even though I find their lovemaking gross and I find his tantrums gross, you know, and but I am turned on by this idea that you're filling a hole, an emotional hole, with the thing that is in nearest reach, and the value maybe you ascribe to it is this authenticity that Norman was talking about.
Or even the darkness of it, even the, you know, the idea that she, I thought, I was fascinated by the set design. I was fascinated by the contrast between her home and this awful, ugly apartment that he lives in that has nothing attractive about it whatsoever. And I do believe that in Bergman's films, the environments are as important as the action that's going on the screen. The Fanny and Alexander, you see the contrast between the grandmother's house versus the pastor's house. I think that the set design is always really important. When Karen goes to London and meets the sister, that whole apartment set, I was trying to make sense of some of these things just from a point of view of, okay, what might have been the idea behind some of these things. And I think some of them just fail miserably, but I think the ideas behind them were very interesting to me. And it's almost like if I were to want to try to remake a Bergman film, which would be a foolish thing for anybody to try to do, but this one would be one that I think might be worth re-exploring the ideas of it. I do think that there's something about someone who has been through a tragedy like the Holocaust, someone who has lived a life of privilege, as Karen has, you know, the collision of those two personalities and what that might mean for storytelling, I think is very interesting. And it seems to me that was one of the things he was trying to get at. Otherwise, I don't really understand what the Holocaust was doing in there as a thematic element. But this woman who basically hasn't suffered suddenly loses her mother and recognizes how cruel life can be and is drawn to more of its cruelty. That, to me, seems to be something that's hovering in the background there.
yeah, there's this kind of self-immolation going on. I mean, she has a comfortable life that presumably could be the envy of many people, or at least seems like, why would you be such a fool to throw that all away? What is this archaeologist who lives in this dingy little hovel have to offer you? I mean, is the sex that good? Is it that compelling? Obviously, I think there's more to it. In fact, his sexual prowess is even called into question. He's not really a particularly, excellent lover or anything like that. You never get the sense that this is a purely sensual experience. There's some kind of emotional codependency happening here.
Absolutely. And I think that there's something about the idea of somebody suffering that can be very attractive. I think we're particularly, if you haven't suffered in a major way, then a death can really propel you into looking at that. It's certainly been my experience that when great losses have happened in my life, it has pulled me more towards that which is tragic about the human experience. It's the thing that drove me to some of these films in the first place. I think I know a lot of people who wouldn't want to watch an Ingmar Bergman film because they don't want to suffer. And you can't go into some of these films without the willingness to look at those things.
Exactly. That's where this film succeeds in portraying a very sad and dismal situation, but in a way that I find, if not totally convincing, it's compelling enough to hold my attention, and I've watched it through a second time, and as you both have indicated, your admiration for details like B.B. Anderson's performance is really enhanced by kind of understanding, watching it again from the beginning, the different things that go on to lead to this kind of moment of, I guess what you could say is a moment of liberation or self-empowerment, as she herself breaks off the relationship, or at least that's where we're left hanging. We don't know exactly what happens after she picks up her books. In fact, she kind of turns back in his direction slightly, and that's when the camera fades out. You wonder if that was originally scripted as the very final scene, or if they just decided to drop it there. So to me, this is a portrait of really three very flawed people. I mean, even the Max von Sydow character. We've talked about Andreas's passivity, his ineffectualness. I mean, his wife, who he's been, good to, if not necessarily, ignited her passions or anything like that, but he's given her a good life. They've got beautiful children. He catches her running around, and he can hardly break a sweat, or, he gives her a raised eyebrow. That's about as much emotion, and says, if you leave, you can't come back. But even then, we go on to see that he's not really even willing to hold that line. So he is a bit of a sop, I'm sure there's a part of Karen who's very entitled to feel frustrated and disappointed with her husband's lack of response, lack of passion, his inability to meet her on that level, even though he provides for her in so many other ways.
I would also, I mean, I don't know. I don't feel like throwing Andreas under the bus is I my sympathies are fair with him. I feel like that, his patience for what his wife is going through is kind of a virtue. I mean, I think it's what, anyone would aspire to behave like, as opposed to a tantrum that David would throw, breaking things and hitting people. I feel like what he's doing is he's giving their marriage the best possible opportunity to, return to a state of grace.
He's sensible. He's not blowing things up.
Yeah,
right. I do agree with that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't feel like, David's id is where he should be,
But is that what Karen's looking for, though? I mean,
I think so.
In a rational sense, she probably appreciates that he's not getting abusive and violent. But at the same time,
she doesn't give him the opportunity. I don't think she gives Andreas the opportunity to be a different person in that marriage. If she's attracted to David's darkness because it gives her permission to be as dark as she wants to. You know how like you can be seen as a different person with a stranger? But you cannot create a transformation within yourself with someone who knows who they're looking at.
Yeah, you've been together for 15 years and presumably before even marriage. So they're pretty well known through and through. And if you try to transform yourself, it's just going to be a laughable comic pose, you know, some kind of a farce that you're trying to pull off, like, this is the new me, you know?
Right, you can't do it. You can't commit to it. So I don't feel like she gives Andreas the proper evidence to judge the situation. You know, he sees that something's wrong. He asks her multiple times, is there anything else you want to tell me? And she presents the peppy housewife that she thinks that he wants from her. So I feel like I have my sympathies with Andreas. I mean, even though he goes to the apartment really for the exact point that David calls him out for, he's there to humiliate them both. He doesn't really have a point to make other than, just so everybody knows, I know. But I don't feel like that's really too much of an indictment either. Go ahead.
Well, this is what I get from so many of these, especially this middle period of Bergman, that unavoidable self-consciousness. I mean, Scenes from a Marriage has so much of it where it's just like, they know that they know that they're messing things up, but they cannot help it because they're just so deep in the weeds of conflict and enmeshment with each other. And it's like nobody can hit the pause button and just say, okay, let's just chill out, you know? Yeah. And that, to me, that's what makes these, you know, adult movies in the best way, because they're so full of nuance, because they feel like real characters who have flaws and brokenness, but also virtues and power and you know, character qualities that make them distinct. And yet, you know, Karen and Andreas are very attracted to each other, and she has ultimately this sense of duty that keeps her connected. And I think that's how a lot of relationships really function. And yet in this ideal fantasy world, if we allow ourselves to indulge in it, we can think of a partner who's just a little bit more of what I'm looking for in this area or that area, or even multiple areas. But it's like, are you really going to break that off and dump everything just to chase this down? And of course, you can hardly talk about Bergman, the person, without, you know, referencing all the broken relationships and all the mess of his personal life. And so much of that finds its way onto film and makes these stories just such kind of fascinating Rorschach tests that we can all kind of look into in a mirror of sorts and say, well, now how would I respond if I was in that situation? If I was Andreas and my wife ran out on me, or if I was Karen and found myself in this kind of stultifying existence, how might I respond to this character just barging into my life and declaring his passionate love for me? And how much would I be willing to put up with if this person became creepy and violent and menacing, but still, you know, was willing to take me back, and I still had this thing of wanting to help him out and make him get better and feeling bad for the terrible past that he's had to survive through. I mean, it's just all that stuff just kind of bubbles to the surface and just kind of gets my gears running anyways. And that's what I love about these movies.
Well, it seems to me like at the end, I mean, I'm very curious to hear each of your interpretations of the end, but I really got the impression that she's come to a new place with herself. I don't know what I thought of the end. I don't know. I haven't figured out the end, but the whole idea of I'm learning Italian now, the choice of the greenhouse as a place to meet, then she's standing there with a reflection of herself in the pond, which is a direct callback to Persona. I wasn't sure what I was supposed to feel about her decision at the end. It felt like a movie that was very, very subtle in any kind of sense of resolution. I did not get the sense that her relationship with Andreas had returned to normal. She's calling for him in the dark. Yeah. And so I don't know what we're supposed to feel, but
yeah, there's a lot of loose ends. She's pregnant. She clearly is pregnant, but she's not seen with her husband. Maybe he's moved out. Maybe they're separated and she's going to have to figure this out on her own. But
Well, it seems that they're living together, because she has that moment where she says, you know, where she's calling to him in the middle of the night after she's woken up, and she calls to him and he doesn't respond, or maybe, I don't know, maybe she didn't wake him up. I don't know.
Or maybe he's not there.
But she does talk about it's her duty to remain. Mm-hmm. But yep. I also feel like that, you know, she's learning Italian. She's finding some new way to express the restlessness she feels. She's doing something different with her life. She's come to some new awareness about herself that allows her to reject the craziness of David, which is, I thought, one possible interpretation of the ending. But I was curious what you guys thought.
I'm pretty much on board with that. I think she also says, I've had enough scandal, and this is a small town, and people won't see us. I think she really wants to put the message out there that her time with this guy, this outsider, is done. She's her own woman now. She may indeed be, about to give birth to his child. And who knows what complications might grow out of that, but she's not going to be, enmeshed in a relationship with him or defined by, she dumped her husband to get with this other guy, and she realizes it's also not sustainable to kind of keep two men going, in her life, even though earlier in the film she talks about it may be possible to integrate that. And I'm sure, again, Bergman and his own infidelities probably had many instances where he wished he could kind of keep multiple relationships going indefinitely and keep everybody happy and fulfill his own desires and all of that. So she's speaking the logic of somebody who's really trying to find a way forward from a practically impossible situation. Or if only my partner would just accept that I have this other person in my life besides him or her or whatever. That's not exactly how humans, at least a lot of humans, are not really built that way. But I do believe that, she's come to a process of realization at the end of the film, and that the break with David is more definitive than maybe some of the earlier partings that they went through.
I think the greenhouse site is unfortunately part of a really dumb Eden symbol system that is peppered throughout very unsuccessfully.
Yes, the apple.
We see the apple. The garden is very important at the beginning. So I feel like this is like they've left the garden and now they've been, sent to the greenhouse. But as far as what the final scene it says about their relationship, the way I interpret it is I think the key to why she's willing to move on from David now is that this realization that she had when she left Andreas after he gives her that, moment where, if you leave, then the marriage is over. He gives her that ultimatum and she leaves. She's forced to admit at the airport that she's a tourist. And I feel like that word summarizes the realization that then gets galvanized by the discussion with the sister when she realizes that he does have a great emotional attachment outside of her. It's not a wife, as she first assumes. It's this relationship with his sister. And then she says she's not coming back. And I think she means it. I think she's realized that she has been a tourist in this experience. And the lie that David is calling her out on, I don't think is the lie that he thinks he's calling her out on. I think he's saying, you're lying to me because you're not really going to leave me. This is just another, fight that we're having. It's another outburst. But I think the lie is that she doesn't really love him, and she has realized that she was kind of in love with her own obsession.
Yeah, I really do agree with that very strongly. I think her relationship with him was not really about him as the real person. It was his neediness. It was his intrusiveness, just the fact that this big, dark-haired, furry man just kind of barged his way into her life and kind of found an opening, exploited it, and made himself this unavoidable presence in her reality. It was just like this shocking, compelling thing that happened to hit her right upon the loss of her mother. And again, we have no backstory about the relationship between mom and daughter. But it certainly jolted her world just to the extent of, those reminders of mortality and all of that. And so just this kind of bang-bang disruption that kind of threw her placid life kind of off the rails for a bit. But then she realizes that, even those strong emotions, even those cravings, kind of they have their moment and then they fade out and then it's back to the real life that you actually have, you know? And so those duties, I don't think are some kind of acceptance of some burdensome pressure, you know, conforming because she fell out of line and now she's really sorry and she'll be a good girl and never do that again. I don't think it's that. I think she just recognizes that her children, her husband, her social connections, that is just the life that she has, and she's not seeing anything with him or with her affection, her emotions felt for him that says, I'm going to ditch all of that and follow this new course. There's no dissatisfaction that's deep enough to drive her away or to make her feel she needs to find solace or escape in this other man who himself is pretty unstable. And I wanted to ask, you know, there's that little almost throwaway bit about the sister's hands and this genetic condition that he has, that she has, that he has. And now here's Karen carrying a baby with who knows what kind of genetic conditions. I mean, did that stick with either of you guys, or did that seem like a point that might have driven Karen's decision-making a little bit at all?
Well, it just felt like a hanging thread. There were a couple of those. There was also the Andres's reference to his suicide attempt in the middle of the film, which I didn't track at all. I was like wondering, what is that backstory? The sister thing seemed very bizarre to me. I didn't quite understand what we were supposed to feel from that scene. All of them seemed interesting in terms of what it made me curious about, but I was disappointed that ultimately none of it is followed up on in any kind of meaningful way. What is David doing at the hospital at the very beginning of the movie? What was that about?
Was that when he's recovering from his suicide attempt, or was he doing other things? You know,
or you know, was there some type of test for his genetic abnormalities? I don't know. All of that was confusing to me. But she's at the hospital sobbing, and here's this guy who's an archaeologist. How did he come to be invited over for dinner? That's not clear to me. What was the relationship between he and Andreas? That's not clear to me. So all of those things I felt were just kind of hovering around in the background, but they weren't even interesting enough for me to try to compose my own story around it. They just felt like hanging threads that didn't add up to much, which is one of my big problems with the film as a whole.
Yeah. Well, I feel a little differently about the muscular atrophy thing. I liked it. I liked it a lot, actually. As opposed to the Eden theme, which I thought was really dumb because it's super obvious, I kind of really dug this theme of the festering infection, which is, you know, really fleshed out with the Madonna wooden sculpture that is discovered in the wall of the medieval church that David, in the role of an archaeologist, is working on a restoration project, at least. See, I think that's what he's working on. But there's definitely a restoration of this medieval church, and they do discover this wooden sculpture of Madonna that he says for 500 years has had this hibernating insect larva, an insect they don't even know what it is or how to get rid of it, but there it is eating the sculpture from inside. And it's pretty dramatic, but I loved the thinking about that. That's, you know, an analogy for Karen's problem, like this thing that's inside, and it's a mother figure. You know, the mother figure is very important to Karen. Even David mentions his dead mother briefly. So there's a kind of maternal thread throughout the film. So then when Karen is pregnant, and now she's going to be a mother again, and she is infested with a pregnancy, but then the pregnancy is infested with something. The newborn baby has this genetic predisposition for atrophy. So I kind of put that all together, and you know, David loved he called the insects beautiful. You know, their destruction was beautiful to him. I thought that was kind of well conceived. What did you think, David?
It was an interesting theme, and again, it was kind of cool to see more of Bergman using the old kind of religious sculptures, statues, iconography, kind of weaving that, you know, that kind of throwback to Seventh Seal and some other great historic films, the Winter Light, where, you know, some of that symbolism is kind of played to kind of heavy effect. And on that same level, the very brief kind of letter reading scenes, again, another throwback to Winter Light, where Ingrid Tulin has that great monologue right into the camera. This isn't quite as bold or as dramatic, but it was just kind of fun to see a little echo of that. So yeah, interesting ideas. And again, maybe not as fully developed or, you know, brought to an obvious conclusion, but I think again you see Bergman doing that. He just throws in these little nods to kind of middle brow intelligentsia, you know, just interesting concepts and ideas that he throws in there, kind of a little seasoning to spice up the film and give us things to ponder and threads to kind of draw out and speculate on, but again without a whole lot of real clear this is what it means or this is what it's all about. Yeah.
Well, and you see in some of his other films where he's really, he's so thoughtful about the stories he's trying to tell or the symbols that he's playing with. I felt this movie had a lot of laziness in it. There was, even like I say, that final shot was a direct ripoff of something he'd already done. And I get it. I understand that, excuse me. I understand that need to just, I've got to do something here, and so I'm going to fall back on my bag of tricks. But I didn't feel that he'd really fleshed out the story he was telling. I think he admits as much in some of the interviews that I've read. Is he wasn't happy with this movie. He wasn't happy with his work on the movie. Even when he talks about the title, he says it was as good as any other.
Yep.
I think that there was a certain sense of he was at a point in his career where he was trying to figure out what he was going to do next, and this was a sketch of something that he didn't really follow through on and finish the painting. That's what I felt.
We can talk about the business side of it as well. This is a film that was produced by ABC Productions, ABC like the TV network. So it's got a different opening. It's not the stark, you know, black background with white lettering, kind of that austere Scandinavian, you know, very sleek, very impressive opening. It's got, you know, more of a, you know, kind of a conventional, there's kind of a little prologue, the scene of B.B. Anderson driving her car up to the hospital, running inside, discovering her mother's passed away. And then after that, then we have the opening credits in color with a little soundtrack and this kind of little picturesque travelogue, which I don't know if you guys caught this, but Gunnar Fischer, the previous cinematographer before Sven Nykvist, was the guy who was assigned to do the main title. So I don't know how often Fischer and Nykvist worked on the same film, but that was kind of a nice little, you know, tribute there, little connection I just caught in the credits this morning when I rewatched the film again. So, you know, so there's kind of that little, what am I trying to think of here? Kind of a little bit of a cocktail party thing going on. You know, the ABC TV now has access to Ingmar Bergman. So there's a little bit of a boasting point, and even the idea of casting actors like Paul Newman or Robert Redford. I mean, would they have made convincing Holocaust concentration camp survivors, or, you know, people who had to flee to New York, you know, from Germany, or wherever Elliot or David's family was from?
I think Dustin Hoffman was also part of that.
Hoffman, I think, would have definitely been appropriate casting.
Well,
I think
certainly not Robert Redford, but Paul Newman. Right. Paul Newman could have pulled it off. I mean, Paul Newman, I thought, was a really fine actor that was always underrated. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Paul Newman, I could understand her being obsessed with.
and Lee Vollman was also originally apparently they had this in mind for her, which I am actually glad that it was B.B. Anderson. I think this might have been B.B.'s maybe the last major role. I don't know. I have to look at my Bergman filmography a little bit, but I don't think she may have done some short, small appearances. But this one, I really appreciate what B.B. did. She gave a lot of herself for this role, obviously, including, you know, some you know, I thought tasteful nudity and all of that. But I really felt like, you know, she was one of those women who was kind of passed over by Bergman in favor of Lee Vollman as he, you know, cast his eye towards younger partners. And she was a little skittish about taking this role, but she also felt like, if Ingmar wants me to do a role, I will never say no. What did you guys think about her particular performance?
I think B.B. Anderson could do no wrong. So yeah. I thought she was great. Even when I felt like she struggled with the dialogue, I felt it was a valiant struggle. I felt that she's always present, and there's always something very interesting going on inside her eyes. I was really sad when she passed away a few months ago, just because I felt so moved by so much of her work over the years.
And no disrespect to Lee Volman, because she's brilliant as well, but I really think B.B. was a better choice for this role. I mean, I don't know if you guys have a concurring or differing opinion on that. Lee could have done a fine job, but I'm glad that it worked out this way.
There's a wholesomeness to B.B. Anderson that I think really helps sell the domestic bliss aspect of the film. You know, I just feel like she her energy is right for this role. I completely agree that she's the one who holds this thing together. I think she's great. I really don't think she misses a beat. I think when things are awkward, it's never something she's doing.
I agree with that.
All right. Well, I think we've pretty well covered the basic points. Did either of you guys have a chance to watch the supplemental documentary simply titled Ingmar Bergman?
I didn't either.
It's really good. In fact, I may actually cover it in my podcast, because it's a 55-minute film that was made by Stig Bjorkman, who did some other work with Bergman. And it's basically it's not so much the making of The Touch, because I don't think The Touch as a film was regarded as a film that needed to have a making of documentary, but it was shot as Bergman was making this movie. And so B.B. Anderson and Elliot Gould and Max von Sydow are all interviewed, as well as Bergman himself. So since you guys haven't watched it, I won't say a whole lot more about it, except I think it's very highly recommended, especially since we are treated to several documentaries about Bergman making films. There's Ingmar Bergman Makes a Movie, which was about the making of Winter Light. And of course, there's a pretty excellent The Making of Fanny and Alexander from later in his career. So, you know, for people who really want to study not just the works of the directors, but the director's process and the intelligence behind what he does, it's an hour very well spent just to, you know, kind of get into Bergman's thoughts as he was making the film. He does a lot of reflection about the nature of the film industry and his own career. And so even though this may not have been a film, an experience that he looked upon fondly, it's still pretty cool to have this document of what he was thinking and going through at this kind of middle juncture. You know, he had some really amazing films, you know, in the near future that are almost universally acclaimed, also very heavy, you know, Cries and Whispers in particular. This here was a little bit of make work. You know, he signed on a deal with an American studio and still filmed in Sweden, still filmed in locations close to him. But yeah, it did feel like he maybe stretched his boundaries a little bit, decided he didn't really like going there. And much like Karen at the end of the film says, I'm not going to pursue that relationship any further.
I can only imagine that he was frustrated by American film executives. Only imagine that was the case.
Yeah. Any anecdotes you want to share along those lines, Norman?
Well, I just think it's such a different sensibility, and I'm sure that ABC Films was a entity during that period of time that was trying to really make inroads into the film business, and a lot of it was really driven by more commercial concerns than. I'm sure it was a frustrating experience for him. I can only imagine.
Yeah, the flip-flopping around of different cast members and lead actors and looking at these kind of Hollywood celebrity types.
Apparently there's a version of the entire film that's in English. I'm glad that I didn't see that version, because I hear it was really hard to sit through. The American executives insisted that they do an English version, totally English version. So I'm sure there was probably stresses just from that, just knowing, now we have to shoot the same scene in English. And It's apparently all of the Swedish speakers were speaking English to each other in a very stilted way. So,
yeah, that's probably one supplemental feature I'm glad we don't have. All right. Well, any final comments or wrap-ups that you have on the Touch? I think it's been a good discussion. I think it's very recommendable. It's just, that's definitely one that you know, people going through, working their way through the big Bergman box, or if you want to watch it on the Criterion channel, it is available there, which is nice. I don't think it was available on Filmstruck earlier on. So,
well, I think definitely that as I said before we started the podcast, even bad Bergman is interesting to watch. So certainly I would agree with you that it's worth recommending. I feel like there's always something to learn from master filmmakers.
Absolutely. Jordan, any final summations you got on the Touch?
I agree. It's very recommendable. I think it's a good film. I think, you know, despite all of its flaws and some of the, you know, the bad writing, the bad performance by Elliot Gould, there's still some really interesting things in play, you know, like this statement about arbitrary obsession, about arbitrariness in general, I think. It's very cool. The problem with it is that it does exist in the company of these towering achievements like Cries and Whispers, which was the very next narrative feature he made, you know, and not that long after things like Hour of the Wolf and Persona. So in that company, it really can't swim. But if you can somehow divorce yourself from that context and just see it on its own merits, I think it's not only worth seeing, but revisiting.
Very good. Well, Norman, before we let you go, I do want to kind of just hear a little bit more about your work. And if you'd also like to tell listeners about the David Whaley Foundation and just kind of let us know a little bit about your world and what you do. And I also just want to thank you for your contributions to this episode and look forward to having you on again. But tell us a little bit more about what you do and just kind of put it out.
Well, yeah, directing in television is quite different than directing a feature in the sense that you're hired at the behest of the writer. So, you know, it's a different discipline. It's something that I really enjoy doing by virtue of that set of challenges, trying to bring your own vision to serve the vision of another. I really am lucky that I do get to do what I am able to work at as a profession, and I enjoy the work I do. I am very satisfied working as a television director. I was married for many years to a wonderful painter, David Whaley, and he passed away 5 years ago. And I decided after that I needed to find a proactive way to deal with my grief, because I do believe that loss is a very ever-present part of life. It was actually the second time I was widowed. And so I formed this foundation to support Southern California artists, because I think that the art world can be very cliquish. It can be very difficult to break into. It can be very difficult for a lot of artists, both young artists and mid-career artists. So over the past 3 years, we've given grants to unrestricted grants to various artists who are mid-career, who are emerging, and also to artist teachers, because a lot of artists have to support themselves by teaching. And my husband David had a great heart for teaching. And so I wanted to find a way to proactively make meaning out of the loss. And so I feel really good about that. I feel we just celebrated our third anniversary, and we've given out almost $50,000 in grants, and I feel very pleased about that. So thank you for asking.
Absolutely. And I just kind of visited the website this morning, just following some of the links that Jordan sent me. And I will post links to the show notes. David did some pretty beautiful work, very colorful, very vibrant. And I'm sure there's a lot more of a story behind that than just meets the eye. But it's good work. And I really respect and support what you're doing. So invite listeners to check that out and maybe consider offering some measure of support if you feel so led.
Yeah, I appreciate that very much.
Excellent. Well, yeah, and I really do appreciate you getting on here and sharing your thoughts and even cutting against the grain a little bit. You know, we don't always have to be rah-rah cheering section about these movies. I thought you made great points, And like I say, you're probably not too far from Bergman's own assessment as well. So it's been good having you both on, listeners. I really do appreciate you tuning in. I just want to say a little bit about the podcast. I'm going to be a little bit slower production for a while. I've got a trip out to California coming up in July, and my work is going through a lot of stuff. I'm putting a lot of extra hours in, a lot of big projects, accreditation. I won't go into the details, but I may not be quite as prolific in the podcasting over the next couple months, so bear with me, but I'm not giving up. I'm not checking out. I'm going to keep plugging away. It's just like life demands every so often. You got to, you know, slow down the pace and pay attention to other things. So I'm not sure exactly when the next episode will be up, but I'll be doing creative stuff and you'll be hearing from me soon enough. So thank you for listening, and everybody, Jordan and Norman, one more time, thanks, and we'll be all talking to you real soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.